Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with our co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Today is March 22nd, 2012, and I want to thank everyone for listening to these free, informative, and educational broadcasts. You can be part of this educational movement simply by telling your friends to listen into these shows. Send them an email with a link, tweet it on Twitter, post the share button on Facebook, and on Dig, StumbleUpon, Reddit, MySpace, or any of the other social networks. You can even copy the embed code of this show for your own website or blog and add something special that folks can listen to. Favorite the show and become a regular listener and click the reminder button. You can contact me, Debbie, at homeopathyworldcommunity@gmail.com or get onto the Facebook page Homeopathy World Community. I'm not sure, Alan, how would the people contact you?
Anyone can contact me by going to vaccinerights.com, and there is information at the bottom of every page telling people how they can contact me, my phone, email, or regular U.S. mail.
Perfect. And also you have a website called pandemicresponseproject.com with informative news, updates, and current events that folks can listen to, and we encourage people also to get to NVIC, the National Vaccine Information. What's the name of that?
NVIC? National Vaccine Information Center.
Center. Okay, yes, and those are really excellent resources for everyone, no matter what part of the world you're in, because right now I see in the chat we have somebody from India who is listening in. And so these are pertinent pieces of information because we talk about current events of what's going on with vaccines and vaccine issues, how it can affect you and your family, your loved ones, and this is important for everyone no matter where you live. Please do send in your comments and questions, and you can even call in live to the show if you have a question. So let's take it away. Tell us where we're starting today.
Well, and I just want a quick follow-up comment that one of the things that I do to the best of my ability and as time allows is to monitor vaccine news from around the world. So it is very definitely an international issue. So I'm absolutely delighted, honored, and flattered to have people from around the U.S. and around the world listening in. So welcome, everyone. We do sometimes talk about legal issues, and necessarily my scope is limited primarily to legal issues here in the U.S., at least to the extent that I can offer insight and comment from my own expertise as an attorney focusing on vaccine rights. But we'll talk about legal issues from around the world as well at times. And I'd like to start off, Debbie, if I can do what might be catching you a little off guard. As Debbie knows, I often find Debbie is very well organized and just a tremendous power for truth and good in the world with all that she does. I don't know how she keeps up with it. I think it would take three of most of the rest of us to do what Debbie does by herself. But she's always asking me in advance, what are we going to talk about this week? And so much of the time, information comes to me the day before or even the morning of a show, and we try to have the information we talk about be current events most of the time. Debbie, I wanted to go back to a show we had a week or two ago and hit a topic again. I think it was the show where you were not with us, if I remember correctly, but to touch back on briefly the issue that concerned Professor John Walker Smith, a British medical doctor who was a co-author with Dr. Andrew Wakefield in the 1998 study that was subsequently very controversial, and both of these doctors and other doctors connected with this published study were brought up on various charges, and in particular Dr. Wakefield and Dr. Walker Smith had their medical licenses taken away. And as you may know, Debbie, Professor John Walker Smith was just recently exonerated in going to, I think what they call a high court. Have to look at the information here. But anyway, the equivalent anyway.
Is this a March 7th piece of news? This Professor Walker Smith cleared and the beginning of the end for allegations against Andrew Wakefield? Or is this something just you heard about this morning?
Well, there have been a series of articles all throughout the alternative healthcare arena about this recent ruling, and we have talked about it recently on the show. I have an article in front of me that's dated April 5th, so I presume it's a not yet published article because it has 2012 on there as well. It just had a little more specific information than we talked about previously, so I just wanted to add briefly some comments to our prior discussion on this as our kickoff point for today, because this is so we have so many setbacks in the alternative arena where the pharmaceutical industry in cahoots with state and federal agencies will push forward, rolling over sometimes in rather blatant ways, in my opinion, legal rights, but certainly moral and ethical considerations to continually expand on the current use of vaccines and continually erode our ability, legally and otherwise, to make an informed choice about vaccines, especially where that might concern saying no thank you to vaccines, or perhaps even no without the thank you. But this is an article that just, again, going back to Professor John Walker Smith, the short story is that he appealed the decision, he was exonerated, he now has his medical license back. According to the article, Professor John Walker Smith and Dr. Andrew Wakefield did not have identical charges leveled against them, so this exoneration of Dr. Walker Smith does not instantly exonerate Andrew Wakefield, although it certainly has some very profound implications. But the article writer makes a reference to the General Medical Council. Now, this is the agency in Britain that licenses medical doctors and the one that undertook supposedly an investigation that concluded that serious violations had occurred on the part of both of these doctors and subsequently took away their medical licenses. And many of us in the alternative community watched this play out and were just floored because we were hearing information that suggested that this whole thing was just a
Maybe for people who really don't know a lot of background, we can just say that Andrew Wakefield was accused of wrongdoing and lost his medical license in regard to allegations for making claims that vaccinations were harmful. Is that correct? Can you clarify that just in like a two-liner? And then
sure.
Explain
sure. A 1998 study published in which Dr. Wakefield and Drs. Wakefield and Walker Smith were co-authors, and the study suggested that there needed to be more research to see whether or not there was a causal relationship between vaccines and autism, because they were finding, I think, vaccination viral strains of measles in the gut of many of the children that they were examining. He didn't claim there was a causal relationship. He suggested that there was reason to investigate that question further. and he was subsequently brought up on charges, I believe they included or consisted of ethics violations. But in any case, it certainly appeared to those of us in the alternative community that this was somebody who had just crossed a political line, and no other lines, but political lines, and that there was, again, whatever you want to call it, a dog and pony show or a witch hunt or what have you, but basically they went through motions that were completely improper, but then nevertheless resulted in the loss of licenses. So according to the article that I saw just this morning that is going to be published soon, the General Medical Council used some very strong language. They found that the General Medical Council, or GMC's, proceedings were, quote, flawed, unquote. They found that its reasoning was, quote, inadequate and superficial, unquote, in some respects to its conclusions, that it was, quote, wrong, unquote, quote, unquote, unjustified. And in one case, again, quote, perverse, unquote. This is very strong language. This is not like you guys made a technical error here and you really should have come up with a different conclusion. This was, you know, you guys totally screwed this up, you know, inside and out, is sort of a rough generalization in layman's terms of what we're hearing here in this language. It's just really very disturbing that you would have an official body conducting a procedure or proceeding that would just be receive such broad and sweeping condemnation from a court, a judge looking at this on appeal of that entity's decision. So I just wanted to sort of underscore how serious this was. There was reference to the fact that the panel either didn't consider at all evidence in favor of Professor John Walker Smith, or that if it did, it should have addressed why that evidence was not persuasive.
So the reason that you wanted to bring this up the very first thing today was to show how the justice system is sometimes flawed, how people are condemned and lose their reputation and their career and everything else and have to defend themselves because of something that is not truthful and maybe targeted to them to make a point. And in fact, in January earlier this year, Dr. Wakefield had sued the British Medical Journal for making all of those claims in the first place and all the years that he had to go through this turmoil in his life, that there was the claim that the MMR study was fraudulent. So they turned his whole life upside down, and it was just, you know, he had to defend himself. And
well, this is, of course, it was catastrophic to the individuals involved because they were fraudulently deprived of their medical licenses. But the implications, as horrible as it was to them as individuals, the implications of this are far, far, far
right.
reaching
and
beyond those individuals. This is a story that was picked up and shared around the world in mainstream news that this terrible, awful, you know, Dr. Andrew Wakefield in Britain did this terrible, awful thing, and we all know vaccines are wonderful, so isn't he a terrible person? And yet when Paul Thorson, who was working with the CDC on studies supposedly showing no connection between vaccines and autism, when he gets indicted on 13 counts of fraud and 9 counts of money laundering, we didn't hear a peep of that in the mainstream news anywhere. And so we need to underscore, not only do some of these medical entities engage in fraudulent practices in order to pursue a political agenda, that our own mainstream media here in the U.S., and I suspect to one degree or another in other parts of the world, deliberately conceals and hides any evidence of wrongdoing on the part of the medical community. It's okay to fraudulently expose someone else whose interests can be appear to be or be presented as being counter to the pharmaceutical industry's profit agenda, but it's somehow absolutely not okay to give a peep of anything that would be contrary to that agenda. The clear implication here being that government policy is controlled by corporations, and we see this in and out of the medical arena. It's not limited to healthcare by any means.
Right. So,
but it's,
so
a,
like
it's a reality of life.
In a broader sense, the purpose of having these shows every week is to create waves of awareness. That is the slogan for Homeopathy World Community. And what that means is listeners need to awaken from their slumber if they're just taking everything on face value that they hear in the media, and that, one, they have to be discerning. They have to listen closely, and they have to investigate for themselves who is saying what and who's going to profit. And then the second really important piece is that each of us has to take action. We have to speak up, speak out, to not only disseminate this information and spread this news about what's really happening, but there are ways that you can be active in the legislative arena, as you say. So do you want to continue with this line of thought, or do you want to go ahead and talk about other news that you have lined up?
Well, let me make just a couple of very quick closing comments, and let's move on, because as you know, Debbie, there's always more to talk about than we ever find time to talk about. But I'll mention that the majority of the topics that we discuss here, especially current events, news items, come from articles that are linked at the Pandemic Response Project website, and that, as you said earlier, is pandemicresponseproject.com, all those words spelled out and run together, Pandemic Response Project. And there's a news, a link to the news page at the top right of the homepage and every other page on that site. A couple of quick comments. The General Medical Council, perhaps predictably, has made a point of saying that the ruling relates only to Professor Walker Smith, and that the other doctors did not appeal, and there's nothing in the judgment here that affects the decision in their cases. As a strict legal matter, that's probably true, but obviously there are profound implications. If the GMC went to such great improper lengths to take Professor Walker Smith's license away, the very strong implication, even if they were totally separate and unrelated charges for Dr. Wakefield and anyone else involved or affected by this, you know, why are we to believe that they were out to lunch in the way they handled Professor Walker Smith's case, but none of the others? It's very unlikely that there was any difference in the way that all of these were addressed in terms of the general ethics or lack thereof. But the judge is reported to say in this article, too, that to have said there is now no respectable body of opinion which supports Dr. Wakefield's hypothesis that MMR vaccine and autism or enterocolitis are causally linked. And I find that comment disturbing, even though I find the judge's ruling in the case welcome it with open arms.
He's saying there's no
respectable body of opinion that supports Dr. Wakefield's hypothesis that
That's
autism
strange.
May be connected to vaccines, which is very strange because there have been a number of studies around the world that have confirmed Dr. Wakefield's study's findings. So that's just
Which goes to show you don't just read the title. You have to investigate further into where they come to their conclusions, because obviously this happens every day of the week, that we hear something in the news, they give us a broad, you know, definite conclusion, this study says that, or this research says that, or this data says that, and it's really when you dig into it, they have maybe didn't even read what was going on underneath the depth of it.
Well, we see this go on over and over again. You know, I read another article or briefly this morning that was talking about a hearing in Vermont on the bill they have there to remove the philosophical exemption, and the article quoted what some people in favor of that bill were saying, and we just see over and over again these broad sweeping statements that are just not based on fact and are directly contradicted by the facts. And I suspect most of these people really believe what they're saying, but they have obviously not bothered to research and see if it's true. And so when people say things like, you know, we have to get rid of the philosophical exemption because look at how terrible and awful polio is, for example. Well, the only cases of polio we've had in the U.S. over recent decades, the majority of them were caused by the vaccine, first of all, when they were still using the live virus vaccine. And maybe there have been, you know, a couple of imported cases of polio where people brought them in from out of the country. But the original polio vaccine, first of all, was introduced after a five-year decline, natural decline, and actually reversed that decline. And the reversal was deliberately covered up by the Public Health Service. And we know this because of expert congressional testimony. It's not a wild conspiracy theory. It's an established fact. And yet people still get up, you know, and testify in front of their state legislators about how, you know, we need these vaccines. And it's just crazy how misinformed, and I don't know a polite word for ignorance, so I'm just going to call like I see it, ignorance on the part of health professionals.
It may not always be ignorance. It may be people defending their turf. So let's go ahead to health authorities now admit severe side effects of vaccination. Swine flu, pandemrics, how do you pronounce that one?
Yeah, I think pandemrics.
Pandemrics and narcolepsy. So this is by Karen Ahumada. I shouldn't have even tried. Dr. MD. And,
we'll just say it comes from orthomolecular.org.
Okay, and what are we learning from this March 20th publication?
This is a very well-written article. I encourage folks to read the whole article. We're just going to pick a few points out of it so we can move on. But this is addressing, again, an issue that I've brought up several times in the last year or two, Debbie, about how there have been narcolepsy cases, mostly in Scandinavia, but I think in some other countries around the world, connected with the swine flu vaccines that were administered primarily in 2009-2010. This is, again, I thought, particularly well-written article. It adds some more details and information that I haven't yet seen, even though I had been following this for the last couple of years. So I want to touch base again. It's yet another, you know, when we first saw the possible connection between narcolepsy and swine flu vaccines, of course, it was denied or played down and what have you, but gradually over time we've seen more and more health authorities in Scandinavian countries coming to terms with the reality that this vaccine has in fact caused severe damage. Some of the things that this article brings out includes the piece of information that they used an adjuvant in these European vaccines that, according to this article, is not allowed here in the USA, the squalene. And so there's at least the suggestion that maybe the squalene is partly responsible for narcolepsy. But, you know, they had, and something we haven't really done, this article gives a brief but I think well-written description of what narcolepsy is and what it encompasses. And I'd like to read this paragraph. It's a short paragraph because we talk about narcolepsy as a disease where you sort of fall asleep randomly or spontaneously. And that's pretty self-explanatory as far as it goes. But I want to read this article here. It goes a little further. Narcolepsy is a severe chronic neurological disease that not only results in a disabling fatigue, which typically results in the patient falling asleep anywhere and at any time. It might also lead to panic attacks and a state of exhaustion. For many, the worst consequences are symptoms of cataplexy. This condition results causes the narcolepsy patient, when expressing strong feelings such as laughter or crying, to suddenly lose muscular control. The legs give way, speech gets slurred, the gaze goes unfocused, the person gives the impression of being drunk, and in some patients, frightening hallucinations appear when falling asleep or waking up. I just think it's really, this is a terrible, terrible, terrible disease. I can't imagine having to live with those kinds of symptoms, and as far as I know, it's a permanent condition.
Although I would love to know if
homeopathy has been successful in treating narcolepsy patients. Maybe we can,
I would like to interject another piece of information. It is not really related to this particular article about the narcolepsy, but it sounds so similar that I think that researchers, physicians, whoever is investigating should take a really close look at it. And this is an article that I recently wrote on Homeopathy World Community called Seizure Knotting Disease in Uganda and Africa. It's in South Africa, Sudan, and Tanzania. There have been CNN reports. There have been many reports over the last couple of years. And it sounds identical to narcolepsy. These children, and it's specifically targeting children ages 3 to 19, but mostly 3 to 11, they are wasting away, and it's called nodding disease because they fall asleep. And then they lose their appetite, and they're afraid to eat because they get sick. And they say that there's no known cause. They cannot figure it out. They say they're trying to link it to river blindness, which is carried by a black fly, but it's not in every person. I mean, it, not every person who gets river blindness gets this nodding disease, and it's really strange. So I have a feeling that when the reality hits, when people look and investigate, that it's possible that these kids might have been vaccinated. I cannot say for sure. I don't have any of the facts. I know that a lot of these children were in camps before they were released and put into their villages. But if you read the symptoms, you would see the similar. Do you hear the birds chirping?
Oh, I do, and it's lovely.
Yeah,
you're outside. Are you today? Let's know where that's coming from.
Yeah, I'm sitting outside, and I have a little birdie sitting right above me, singing a song. So,
well, hopefully not right above you.
Not dropping on my computer, no. really, these are the kinds of things that I wonder about, why people are not looking into it, and whether information is not being fully disclosed. So you're saying that regarding the side effects of the vaccination from swine flu, Pandemrix is the narcolepsy, and it's due very much so to the adjuvants, possibly?
Potentially. I mean, I don't specifically recall, and if I find information to the contrary, I'll bring that up in the future, but I don't specifically recall hearing narcolepsy as a primary complaint as a side effect of the swine flu vaccine here in the U.S., for example. Primarily, when I've heard or read articles about it, it's been in Scandinavian countries and to some extent some other countries around the world. But another thing they point out here in this article, it's really interesting. They say no European countries had a particularly high rate of deaths due to the swine flu, and then they give some figures. And they show, for example, that Germany and Sweden had very similar death rates from the swine flu, but they had radically different vaccination rates. Germany vaccinated 8% of its population, and Sweden vaccinated 60% of its population. So this certainly implies, and this article states this, that the vaccine did little to prevent deaths. And if it's not going to prevent deaths, you know, flu is something that I guess I should defer to medical expertise if we find any on the subject, but I'm not aware of flu as something that's attributed to some sort of debilitating chronic conditions. My general understanding is that flu is something that if you don't die from it, you will recover, and of course the vast majority of people recover from it.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, there's no reason to get the vaccine at all, because if there's a chance that you're going to have some debilitating adverse reaction from the vaccine, and it's not going to prevent deaths, there would be no reason at all to get the vaccine.
Okay. So now we have another article. It comes from the Alliance for Natural Health. And a court has stopped FDA's latest attempt to censor food and supplement science. It's an action alert. And very often when you go to Alliance for Natural Health, you really, they want you to take action. There's probably a petition or some letter writing or editorial thing, something that you can do if this is of interest to you, if you're passionate about it, if you're concerned about health, if you're concerned about your family health or world health, whatever. There are things that you can do. So an FDA disclaimer about green tea and the risk of cancer is so strongly worded that it effectively negates the manufacturer's quality health claim and violates the First Amendment. So this is a legal issue, according to the United District Court Judge Vanessa Bryant. And tell us what it is they're saying is happening.
Well, in general terms, apparently when you have a natural product and you want to make claims about its effectiveness in perhaps treating or preventing disease, the FDA says that in general terms, when you do that, you're making it a drug, and therefore you have to go through this $1 million licensing procedure with the FDA. Well, there's some limited ability to make what they call a qualified health claim, or a QHC, but you have to get permission from the FDA, and they will provide language for that. And
so you're allowed to make some. I mean, if I say oranges are good for your health, or you know, you're going to get some vitamin C by eating orange. Am I allowed to say that?
I'm actually not clear on the precise boundaries. This is a little outside of the vaccine arena, so I'm going to give it to you in generality so that we understand the general concept. And I really don't know where the lines are. But my understanding from this article is that if you want to say something about the health benefits with regard to a particular disease, like I've heard over the years many claims of one kind or another that green tea is a preventative of cancer. So how far can someone go who sells tea, putting information on their product packaging that says, drink this tea, it'll help prevent cancer?
It's a good question. You know, when you go to their website, they're probably going to have a whole long list of research studies which defend that position.
Right, but again, I could say cynically, but there's some support for the statement that the FDA supposedly works for the American public, but in reality, what they really do is they work for the pharmaceutical industry. And that claim came from a medical researcher employed by the FDA who went public about a conversation he had with his boss at the FDA, who told him once that they work for the pharmaceutical industry, and he politely corrected his boss and said, no, you mean we work for the American public? And he said, no, our client is the industry. The FDA, by its own admission, at least by some insiders, is not set up to maximize health. It's set up to maximize profit of the pharmaceutical industry, and that's a real shame because it's not supposed to be doing that. But the current state of affairs is that if you have a non-drug product, something essentially that would potentially compete with drugs as a product that consumers might want to have if they had complete information about the choices and options, you've got to get, again, as I understand it here, at least in some situations, you've got to get permission from the FDA, and they get to provide you language that you have to include to make sure that you're not supposedly misleading the public. Not that people potentially from any side of the issue in terms of pro-pharma or pro-alternative health or any mixture of the two, we're all human and potentially prone to deliberate or inadvertently misleading. So it's good to have an independent third body who's checking or at least available
can
to
I
check
ask,
language on
can,
things.
Can but, I ask you a question? In medical terms, maybe you don't know the answers to this question. Do doctors say that antioxidants clean up free radicals and help prevent cancer? Is that true? Is that something that the medical profession believes is true?
It's my understanding that there's research to back the idea that green tea may have a beneficial effect on with regard to cancer, but beyond my general understanding, I'm not up to speed on that point. But the purpose, the point of this article was that the FDA says, okay, you can make your claim as long as you include this additional language, and the additional language completely negates the claim.
Oh, really?
No. Yeah, and so they basically sued. They said this is a First Amendment free speech issue, that we're allowed to say things as long as we're not, you know, misleading and so forth. The bottom line here is they won the case, and it opens the door for the possibility that
they had to take the labeling off of the package.
The FDA lost the case. I was not clear about that. And they were instructed by the court to provide more appropriate language. The court recognized that the language they were requiring the green tea manufacturer to include completely negated the beneficial claim that the green tea manufacturer wanted to use. In other words, they had to say something like, you know, green tea is beneficial, except that it's not beneficial. You know, I'm summarizing in very vague general terms here, but the point was, it's like there's no point in making their statement
is this what they asked them to say? The FDA concludes that it is highly unlikely that green tea reduces the risk of breast cancer or prostate cancer, so they wanted them to add that, even though they have, it's called Tea for Health.
Yeah, again, what the FDA was requiring is that they add language that completely negated the beneficial claim that they wanted to put in. And the court said, FDA, you're overstepping your boundaries, back off, use, you know, more appropriate language. But I think the biggest takeaway from this article is that it's talking about a bill that is currently before Congress, the Free Speech About Science Act, which would clear the way for anybody who's got published medical studies supporting their assertion to be able to make the assertion. You can't do that right now. And this seems to me like one of those kind of common sense no-brainers. Why would you not already be able to do that? And the answer is that the FDA works for industry, and industry profits are threatened by products that they can't control. And so if there's an alternative healthcare approach that works well and might be something somebody would choose rather than going out and getting a prescription and using a pharmaceutical approach to the problem, then the industry doesn't want people to know about that or do it. And apparently the FDA doesn't want them to know about or do that either, because, again, they're not – if the FDA was truly neutral in wanting to help people, it would be – completely open and supportive of any supportable claim. I mean, any claim that is reasonably supported. And if you've got a published medical study or studies that supports your claim, you ought to be able to make that claim freely without anybody challenging you on it. You can't do that right now, if I understand this article and the current state of the law on that point. So I encourage people to go to the article on the website. You can do an internet search for Alliance for Natural Health, and that'll get you there. They have set up things, you know, take action buttons where they will automatically connect you with your own congressional representatives and help you get a message out. I love the way that these things are automated because it enables people who otherwise would not have time to participate in the legislative process to do so, spending only a few moments of their time. So I really encourage folks here in the U.S. to do that.
Right. So this is what I was saying earlier in the show, that once you become aware and you become discerning that there is an action step that you can take to make your opinion known to those people who have influence and power over your life. And so there is a bill before Congress, the Free Speech About Science Act, and so you could check that out. And if you have not already done so, to contact Congress and ask your legislators to co-sponsor H.R. 1364, the Free Speech About Science Act.
We need that desperately, and it's, again, it, to me, it just seems so, I don't know really many other words for it, bizarre, that something that seems so common sense on its face would be something that we would have to fight against or fight for to get in place
to,
in the first
we
place.
Have to keep, we have to keep fighting for our constitutional rights because they keep getting whittled away. So let's go ahead with the next article. Is the worst of both worlds, genetically engineered goats to produce new vaccines. And what's this one about?
Yeah, this is one that falls in that realm of reality is stranger than fiction. You know, I feel like we're veering off into kind of sci-fi world here with this one. It's just out there on the bizarre edge. Maybe I'm going to overuse that word today. But in any case, believe it or not, and this comes from Mercola.com, Dr. Joseph Mercola's site. Dr. Mercola, for those who are not already familiar with him, is a wonderful promoter of alternative views. He's very critical of establishment because of all the politics that's involved. He's very interested in truth. I think he will support truth wherever it comes from. It's just that in the healthcare arena, it doesn't come often enough from mainstream sources.
This is kind of scary. I think about goats as being one of the purest animals. All of the people, all of the children who are allergic to dairy, who can't drink milk, whose mothers can't produce milk, what do they need to give their children? Goat's milk. Why? Goat's milk is the closest thing to mother's milk as any other nutritional value out there, as any other food. It's goat's milk. And it's so delicious and good for you. And, you know, it's really hard to get today in America, the raw kind also. So they're going to try to genetically engineer these poor animals to give us a hidden vaccine when we drink milk. How are they going to do this?
Well, I have to throw in this little pun here at the top because it really, you got to grab your humor where you can in these kind of scenarios. They're talking about genetically engineering goats to turn them into farm animals. Farm spelled P-H-A-R-M.
It should have been farm animals, not farm.
Yeah.
They're already farm animals. They need to be, you know, left in their natural state. Okay, so what's going to happen?
Well, they want to design the goats so that they carry vaccines in their milk so that children in third world countries who need only drink the goat's milk to be vaccinated. So they're doing experiments now at Texas A&M to produce an edible malaria vaccine. Again, the ultimate goal being that children just drink the milk and they become vaccinated in the process.
Nobody who asked? Who wanted it? Who, you know, I didn't give permission.
These things are usually driven by the economics. There is a growing market for vaccines in third world countries, and so anybody who can come up with, you know, the clever best way to deliver vaccines and the most effective vaccines is going to be at the top of that market. I mean, every man, woman, and child on the planet is a potential recipient of vaccines from the moment of birth until, I don't know, they'll probably even have one that you have to have in your casket, you know, to keep everybody at the, you know, at the morgue and the wake safe, I suppose. I mean, I don't even know if they'll stop at death. But in any case, there's just an enormous potential market there, and there's no limit to the number of different kinds of vaccines and the number of boosters for any one vaccine that somebody
might
get.
So we don't even know if the milk we're buying today from our stores, because we don't have freedom in labeling yet, whether we're getting something we don't know.
Well, I think it's safe to say that we often get things that we either don't know what it is, or if we have some word or label for what it is, we don't know what the implications of the word or label really are. So we definitely need to keep pursuing the right to know what's in the foods we buy and eat, and therefore impose mandatory labeling in plain English that we can all understand, so that we can make informed decisions. That's something we're struggling with, particularly with GMOs right now.
I was going to jump over to that category of information, because we're right now in such a heated battle about Monsanto producing sterile seeds so that people cannot sustain themselves anymore, and contaminating the natural wild seed that has the fundamental foundation of all of our foods in the world, and they are destroying that. Now, let's say they're going to jump over to the animals and they start breeding these goats, and now when does it stop? Where does it end? And you don't have any control anymore. Plus, down the line, you don't know 10, 20, 30, 40 years from now, what is this actually doing to the goats and the goat's milk?
And the people who drink it. And we're going to see, you know, there are a number of risks here with this idea. And we've got some track record with GMOs as an analogy where the research has either been incomplete in many instances or shown potential adverse events that just really have not been clearly explained or exposed or what have you. But now we have, you know, with plants, I think there are some distinct differences. We have people who have farmers who've had, were not growing GMO crops, but have had their crops
cross-pollinated,
and that there are just elements to this that you can't control, and there are so many questions that we don't know the answers to. What is the potential long-term impact, whether you're talking about goats or plants, of these procedures, of these processes? You know, on the one hand, that's a fascinating concept, interesting idea, but what are the consequences when you start messing with the genes? You get into an area where you really have no idea what the implications are, what the consequences, good or bad, are going to be, because this is uncharted territory in terms of nature. Sort of by definition, it's uncharted.
Why do people think that? Why do these researchers think that they're so smart? I mean, I don't understand it. They have a pea-sized amount of information, and they're going ahead doing things to manipulate populations of, you know, plants, animals, and humans. I just can't fathom the nerve that they have to do these things.
Well, in one sense, it can be summarized very quickly, and perhaps it's somewhat of an oversimplification, but I think it's a valid way of putting it, and it could boil down to this, that greed comes with blinders. You know, there's lots of money to be made here, and people pursue research. What research gets pursued is based on what looks like it has prospects for the best return financially on the investment put into the research. And so that can blind one to the real costs or real long-term costs or the absence of information about the real costs or the absence of initiative to pursue research to determine. You don't want to see something that weighs, you know, that potentially is going to undermine the profits. And so there's a disincentive to look in that direction. But as long as it's money-driven, then it will not be able to be objective and open, transparent, and so forth. These are contradictory concepts. So, you know, we could, not here on this show, of course, but we could broaden that whole conversation into the question, does capitalism work? And if not, what variation of capitalism or other system entirely would be the most suitable replacement? I find myself personally leaning more and more in the direction of capitalism, at least as we now know it, just simply doesn't work. It puts financial motives ahead of everything else, and that's going to necessarily skew or subvert health, well-being, those things that are really most important to having a meaningful life. But in any case, there are many concerns, and the article, again, linked from the Pandemic Response Project news page, goes into some depth and detail. You know, it's, Dr. Mercola argues that giving immune-compromised children vaccines, which is what you're doing in third world countries, may create illness, not cure it. And we've seen historically that infectious disease decline parallels improvements in sanitation, in food preservation, and not the administration of vaccines. So the idea of vaccines are going to fix everything is inconsistent with decades of historical precedent, and again is probably something based on the pursuit of profit far, far more and above a genuine objective pursuit of what is going to maximize health for people around the world.
Yes, so we know there's a song, Money Makes the World Go Around. And if you could just sing that in your head, you would know that that's really the basis of everything, because it's the commodity of exchange, and it is really what makes the world go around. So that is important to always keep uppermost in your mind and even in your daily transactions, what is motivating you as an individual, me as an individual, to do and say the things that we do. And, you know, we have to really look into our hearts and realize, what do we want to our world to look like? And if the people who were in charge, who were in authority, could see that what these people really need are Maslow's basics of living, sanitation, nutritional food, sunlight, shelter, loving homes, and not to be separated from their families, not to be have crime or to be injured in any way in war. If those were the things that we spent these billions and billions of dollars on, we would probably boost our immune system so high that all of these diseases, you know, they really wouldn't be as effective as epidemic level. That's really what I want to say.
Well, and that's historically when and how and why they've disappeared. You know, the big argument we see against exemptions when we're fighting over legislative initiatives here in the U.S. is that, well, if we, you know, allow and promote and encourage exemptions, then we're going to see a rushback of all these diseases. Dr. Russell Blaylock wrote an article. He's a neurologist who has written and extensively about problems with vaccines and has that unique and insightful perspective of a neurologist at times. But he made a real interesting point recently, Debbie, that I'd just like to relay, because it's one that I hadn't thought about. You know, there's always more to learn on this. We our current population here in the United States is well over 50% of it are adults who are the so-called baby boomers. And the baby boomers were last vaccinated as kids decades ago. And the prevailing conventional wisdom is that vaccine protection, let's just assume for the moment that vaccines, when they generate antibodies, that constitutes immunity. That's a whole separate question that is very debatable, actually has been disproven by published medical studies. But for the moment, let's assume that that's true in order to make the point. Vaccine immunity lasts on the order of 2 to 10 years, depending on the vaccine. So well over half of our population, the adult baby boomers, have not had any vaccine protection for something on the order of 30, 40 years or more. And yet we've not seen a resurgence of any of these childhood infectious diseases. Well, we wouldn't expect to when you consider the fact that 90 to 95% of the decline preceded vaccines. So absence of continued vaccination for those people shouldn't bring the diseases back unless there was some reversal
there
in sanitation
little,
and other things.
Aren't there little pockets like the whooping cough and things like that, or not?
Well, we certainly see those diseases. We certainly see those diseases from time to time in different places. Pertussis is particularly notable example in that, and usually, by the way, and the CDC admits this on their website, that most outbreaks do occur in vaccinated people. But and that's because, as the CDC points out, 5 to 15% is their figures. 5 to 15% of vaccinated people do not get the immune response. In other words, the vaccines don't work in everybody. And so that's why, according to the CDC, again, diseases occur in vaccinated children, in particular when they're talking about recently vaccinated people, that even being fully up to date on your vaccines doesn't mean you're not going to get sick. So, but the point being that the whole premise that you don't get to choose what goes into your body as it concerns vaccines is this notion that you being unvaccinated puts me at risk. Well, if the vaccines work, then how does an unvaccinated person, you know, put anyone at risk? But the point is that that whole premise, the reason why all of the freedom, personal freedom issues that apply or arguments that apply to other situations don't apply to vaccines, that whole premise rests on the assumption that herd immunity works. And we've seen over and over again that herd immunity doesn't work. But again, one of the most dramatic examples, and there are published medical studies showing outbreaks in highly and even fully vaccinated populations and so forth. But Dr. Blaylock's point was, well, look, you know, majority of our population has been not vaccinated or had no vaccine protection for decades. And we haven't seen a resurgence of infectious disease in any significant sense. And with pertussis, let me go back to that real quick. Pertussis goes in cycles, 3 to 4 year cycles typically. Immunization exemptions and immunization does not go in 3 to 4 year cycles. So clearly there's something else going on here with pertussis other than whether or not somebody's immunized or what the immunization rates are. Or clearly pertussis is not caused by people exercising exemptions, for example, because they represent a tiny fraction of the number of vaccinated people who are not immune because the vaccines don't work, according to the CDC.
How about on our next, do you have a concluding message? Because I was going to say, how about on our next show, we talk a little bit more about the herd immunity issue?
We can certainly do that. One or more of the recent articles have addressed that issue, and that's a subject that really bears looking into. We can definitely get into that next week more.
Okay, so March 29th, we'll talk about the herd immunity issue. And I want to thank you again. Our time really flew by. I learned a lot today by highlighting and investigating these particular articles and issues. And I want to just thank our listeners so much for tuning in, for sharing, for becoming a friend, putting reminders on, tweeting it, putting on your Facebook, or even sending it in an email, because these are really life-changing issues. And we also have on Monday night Grant Bentley talking about homeopathy and facial analysis. On Wednesday morning at 11, Dr. Adil will be on from India. He's a cardiologist talking about our heart and how we can keep our heart healthy both through Reiki and nutrition, exercise, and also what to do with acute or chronic illness and homeopathic remedies. From his point of view, he has a lot of experience. Then we also have on Thursday, starting at 11 a.m., Dr. Christina Chambreau talks about keeping a pet healthy. And that was a really great show today about diet nutrition. We're going to continue that next week. And I want to highlight a special show, and there's only 1 minute left before I'm cut off here. And that is on Monday, we're going to have a live stream video show. So look at Homeopathy World Community Events, and you will find it there. Thank you so much, Alan, for being with us.
Thank you, Debbie, for making this possible.
Okay, we're going to end the show.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Let your truth be unfurled.